This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Last week, the Department of the Interior approved the plan to preserve the culture of Sea Island slave descendants along the southeast coast. The Gullah Geechee Corridor, more than a dozen years in the making, will preserve historically significant sites from southeastern North Carolina to points farther south. L.C. Morris has this update.
During the slave trade between the 16th and 18th centuries, an estimated 12 million captured Africans were destined for American plantations. Many ended up in South Carolina, then transported to North Carolina in the lower Cape Fear River Basin. Ulysses Willis is a descendant of those enslaved people who first inhabited Eagles Island. Willis grew up in a town called Navassa, only 4 miles from what is now considered downtown Wilmington.
Back in antebellum days, most of the plantations in this area were rice plantations, contrary to what the image that you get when you watch Gone with the Wind or some of those stories, you know, where you see all the cotton fields and Old Man River and all that kind of stuff. We did not have that here.
The Gullah represent one of the oldest culture groups surviving among us today between Jacksonville, North Carolina, and Jacksonville, Florida, along the Atlantic Ocean. Preserving the culture of the Gullah Geechee is an ongoing mission. The Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor was designated by an act of Congress on October 12, 2006. It was authorized as a part of the National Heritage Areas Act of 2006. As a National Heritage Area, Eagles Island is not officially part of the National Park System. The corridor was created to recognize the important contributions made to American culture. Ronald Days, who is chairman of the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor Commission, explains why Gullah and Geechee had been overlooked for so many years.
Many people said that as a language and as a culture, they were not familiar with the word Gullah until, say, the late 80s or 90s, that was a term used by historians and anthropologists. In one community to another, it was stated, no, we are the same people. So as part of the document, the management plan for the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor, it's noted as Gullah Geechee.
The Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor Commission is made up of a 15-member commission who will oversee up to $10 million over the next 4 years for the corridor. Now that the U.S. Department of Interior has approved a management plan for the Gullah Geechee Heritage Corridor, the mission of identifying and preserving sites, historical data, artifacts, and objects associated with Gullah Geechee is on to its next phase.
Partners for the commission are the only ways in which the management plan will be executed. It's not up to the commission. The commission was only responsible for developing the management plan.
The corridor is just over 12,000 miles from Wilmington, North Carolina, south along the coast of the Atlantic Ocean through South Carolina, Georgia, and on into St. Augustine, Florida. The commission is federally funded.
Since the management plan development was begun, the commission has received about $148,000 annually, which accounted for the development, the production of the management plan. The management plan was produced and completed in last fiscal year. There is promised to be a financial bump in the federal appropriations that we will receive. However, the bulk of monies will come through partners.
Days says it's not up to the commission to maintain sustainability of the corridor.
They can make an application with a proposal about how interpretive programs about Gullah Geechee culture in North Carolina can be represented.
The commission is looking for more sites in North Carolina like Williston Middle School in Wilmington to be identified, and that is where the partners come in. I'm L.C. Morris.
Coming up this weekend, the Ocracoke-based band Coyote will perform concerts in New Bern, Beaufort, and Swansboro. Although they sometimes perform as members of Molasses Creek, this husband and wife duo shine on their own, playing a variety of musical styles from Cajun to jazz, from folk to country. This week, I spoke with Marcy Brenner about their upcoming concerts and the inspiration behind their music.
So we're really kind of all over the place. We play the instruments that we love the sound of, because it's really more about the sound than anything else. We're looking for a certain sound.
You play in this band with your husband, Lou. How did you guys meet? How did you guys start playing music together?
We met in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and came together through music, and just have been together ever since the second time we played music together. And we've been married for 10 years. And the name Coyote comes from the first song that we learned together. It's a Joni Mitchell song called Coyote. And my songwriting mentor in Los Angeles, Coyote was kind of his totem. And so I sort of took that as my logo when I moved from California back to North Carolina, which is, you know, home.
Which came first, Molasses Creek or Coyote?
In the history of the world, Molasses Creek came first. In the history of Marcy and Lou, Coyote came first.
So you and Lou have been playing together for about 10 years now as Coyote. How would you describe your sound?
Lou made a fictitious tagline once that is an eclectic collection of acoustic selections, which is silly. But it's what it is. We just really do have an eclectic selection of songs. Everything from Fats Waller to Led Zeppelin to Joni Mitchell to Scottish songwriters you will have never known about. So we're all over to original tunes.
Now, it takes amazing skill and years of hard work and practice to learn just one instrument, but both you and Lou play multiple instruments, some I've never even heard of. Tell me about the instruments you'll be playing this weekend.
I play mandolin and guitar and cittern, C-I-T-T-E-R-N, which is a Celtic long neck instrument. And I play a banjolin and I play percussion. Lou will be playing guitar and dobro and classical guitar.
Both you and Lou perform with the internationally known Molasses Creek, and you guys perform up and down the East Coast. But with Coyote, do you try to keep it more local?
Yes, although we would go anywhere, but lately we're really pretty local. Mm-hmm.
And how does living on Ocracoke Island and at the coast influence the music that you write?
A lot, just because of the beautiful setting that we have here and the sense of community. So we just have this beautiful natural world around us and a lot of quiet and just dear friends and community members that, you know, we're all just so close together physically and we take care of each other. So it definitely feeds our art.
In addition to the landscape of Eastern North Carolina, what are some other things that influence the music you write?
Now, I'm a cancer survivor, I'm a breast cancer survivor, and so I'm always kind of doing advocacy work. The whole point for me as an artist is story. I think that it's just really important to share our stories with each other. And for me as an artist, I share them with songs, I share them with short stories and actually storytelling, and then writing.
Dead girl walking on a lonesome road, headed to the chair. Dread comes knocking.
The song Dead Girl Walking I wrote to be brave enough to kind of go first and say what it's like to be an advanced breast cancer survivor. But really, at the end of the day, we're all dead girls walking because nobody gets out of this life alive. So the big question for me is, how are you going to live while you're alive?
Tragedy happens every day. This fear I carry has been
writing original music, it's very personal. It's very much from the heart. What's one of your favorites that you enjoy singing and performing?
I think our favorite would be called 5 Minutes. And it's a jazzy love song. the major line of the song is, "I'd rather love you for 5 minutes than never at all."
Than to live one more day without you, I'd rather love you 5 minutes than never at all. Never have loved you, never loved you at all.
Now, I know you like to do a lot of original music, but do you also do covers as well?
We do. We'll do some Led Zeppelin. We'll do some old jazz standards like Fats Waller and a Celtic song from a writer in Scotland that you would have never heard about. So we do find some elusive songs from writers that that get our attention. So we try to make the covers our own using the instruments that speak to us.
You're going to be playing all over Eastern North Carolina this weekend, Friday night in New Bern, Saturday evening in Beaufort down at Clausen's Restaurant, and Sunday afternoon at Swan Fest. Can you kind of give us a preview on what to expect?
The coyote totem is known as the trickster. And we feel like, as musicians, that's where we are, because you never know what instrument we're going to pick up, what genre we're going to play. You know, we're kind of unexpected. So I think that's what you can expect is just our love for each other, our love for music, our love for the place, you know, where we live on the Outer Banks and the coast of North Carolina. And every selection is going to be different from the last one.
I'm speaking with Marcy Brunner. She's the vocalist, mandolin player, as well as a host of other instruments in the duo from Ocracoke Island, Coyote. Hey, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks.
If you'd like more information on this weekend's performances, visit the events section of our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Many of you have areas in your yard that are mulched. Maybe it's an area around the base of a tree because you want to keep the weed eater away from the bark. An excellent idea. Or it might be a whole growing bed filled with a number of trees and shrubs. In any event, mulch is used to keep an area as weed-free as possible, and here in coastal North Carolina, it can also help keep the soil cool in the summer and moist during dry periods. Most of the time, the mulch used in these areas is wood or bark. It can be large chip size, smaller granules, or even almost fully composted. But in any event, all these materials are organic, a carbon source. And all of them are broken down by all sorts of microorganisms and some larger fungi. It is unlikely that you'll ever notice most of these fungi, but a few of them really do stand out. One is a fairly smelly fungi called, appropriately, a stinkhorn. Stinkhorns first become apparent in moist mulch or other damp, decomposing organic matter in a structure that looks surprisingly like a small egg. When the weather is right, this egg sac will open and the mature mushroom, the stinkhorn, will emerge. Now, there are a number of different stinkhorns, and they take different shapes. The mushroom, which is the fruiting body of the fungus, may be stalk-like or globular. Or, my favorite, it may look like a latticed, well, almost lantern. These may vary in color, but they're usually pink or orange. There's one thing they all have in common, however. They produce a foul odor. The odor travels a distance and attracts ants and flies that then pick up spores and carry them to other locations. Stinkhorns are a beneficial decomposing fungi. They don't cause harm to any plants or animals. However, a lot of people don't appreciate the smell they leave behind. So what can you do about stinkhorns? The easiest thing is just to take a shovel, go underneath the stinkhorn, and flip it upside down in the soil, letting the soil cover it and the smell. If you find the eggs before the mature mushroom opens, well, just lift it, pop it into some sort of sealed bag, and throw it away in the trash. You can remove mulched areas from close to your house. Let's say you don't want the smell of the stinkhorns wafting through your bedroom window. You can remove mulched areas from directly below the window and reduce the number of these smelly pests. Or, because they only occur a couple times a year for a short time, and most people will never see one in their lifetime, you might just enjoy the oddity and strangeness of having one in your yard and leave them alone. I think I mentioned that there were two fungi that stand out in mulch. The other one is an artillery fungus. This one is tiny, but shoots sticky spores at cars and houses. I'll mention that one and tell you more details about it in another segment of the Garden Journal. For now, if you've seen a stinkhorn this spring, enjoy it as much as you can and try to stay upwind. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Southeastern Medical Oncology Center, recognized in clinical research for cancer and hematology patients since 1984, in Goldsboro, Wilson, Clinton, Rocky Mount, and Jacksonville. Southeastern Medical Oncology Center, online at cancersmoc.com.
Is the weekday commute getting to you?
I'm driving right now as I'm online. A propane tanker.
The office getting a little crazy?
I'm impressed, Miss Harrison. I never saw anybody hit an author before.
Well, just a little move we learned in biblio-taekwondo.
On-the-job perks getting smaller?
My very own three-hole punch!
Right. Escape from it all this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at 6 on all of the PRE stations.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. You ready for a little automotive spring cleaning?
Yeah, my car could use it.
Good. I brought 15 flea bombs.
That's a start.
If your car's seen one spring too many, you can donate it to this station. It'll get sold, your station gets the proceeds,
and you get a tax deduction.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
The Muses were, according to Greek mythology, goddesses who inspired literature and the arts. The inspiration for Greenville Resonant's first novel, however, came from a more terrestrial source. George Olson has this, which originally aired in July 2001.
Score one for the radio.
I guess what led to it, it was maybe started by an interview that I heard on NPR with a novelist. But he had said everyone ought to try to write a novel.
Greenville Resident Jim Metzger. But that author who moved him to write his first novel wasn't pushing the idea as a way toward fame and fortune.
It's going to force you to face all kinds of issues you wouldn't otherwise face, even though it's fiction. So it gives you a chance to work out, you know, your ideas, figure out what you're passionate about, what it is you think you may know, what it is you believe, that sort of thing.
The end result for the ECU graduate student and Pitt Community College instructor is DIM, a book that for people of faith puts to the test what it is you think you may know. DIM tells the story of Tom Maloney, a young pastor fresh from divinity school at his first Methodist parish in a rural eastern North Carolina community, who has to confront issues on several fronts, including racism, familial abuse, and homosexuality. In this scene from DIM, Tom is conferring with Janet, a 42-year-old former physician who has moved back to her ancestral home in the fictional town of Harmony as she deals with the ravaging effects of MS.
It's just that my faith has actually helped me deal with the little insignificant sufferings that hit any of us. Bad case of the flu, so bad you'd almost rather die than push through it. A broken leg that robs you of your summer. Simple, ordinary stuff that anybody has to deal with. I always found it helpful to think of these little sufferings as fair punishment for all the bad things I've done. Kind of karma, I guess. It just wouldn't be right if I never suffered at all, given how I've hurt people. I deserve some payback, some pain. I used to tease geeks even lower on the ladder than me, and I shouldn't be allowed to get off scot-free. It's not like I think God is directly sending me the flu for my sins and keeping a running tally of when they're paid in full. But maybe it's not a bad thing to have a little suffering worked into the order of things so that no one gets off scot-free. Plus, they toughen you up a bit, make a man out of you, give you a chance to show a little courage. So, are we to explain Auschwitz or Buchenwald with that theory? The Jews had it coming to them? I suddenly felt squeamish. No, of course not, I stammered, unfamiliar with Buchenwald, barely familiar with Auschwitz. It's a theory that's helped me, that's all. I would never dream of applying it to anyone else, certainly not the sufferings of a whole community like that. It's just a strategy I used to help get me through lousy situations. So are you suggesting that it might apply in my situation? Are my illnesses payback for picking on a nerdy girl in the fourth grade? Is that supposed to be helpful? I began to feel hot, jittery. I'm not sure why I said that, Janet. But you said that you would forgive me, right? Show a little Christian love? She growled as she reached for a glass and ground a cube between her molars.
And that is the character of Tom in a nutshell. Plenty of difficult questions, not too many firm answers. But that's what the author was shooting for. Metzger has degrees in religion from three different schools and has taught religion at three different schools, ECU included. At one of the stops, Luther College in Iowa, he taught a course he describes as part composition, part critical thinking, that used reading as a starting point.
But it struck me at one point, this was early on in the semester, that a few of the novels just weren't good conversation starters. There just wasn't enough meat there to sort of keep things going for several hour-long sessions. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a book that did that, you know, that really opened these issues up and did more of raising questions, like you said, than anything else, than arguing for a particular viewpoint or particular worldview or whatever.
But the congregants at Tom's church aren't too interested in questions. They want answers, firm answers, as Jim Metzger writes in Dim.
Bill, like most in Harmony, needed to see his minister not as a real flesh and blood human being with doubts, but as a man of God who lives and speaks from unshakable certitude.
And that prompts a degree of conflict between Tom and interest inside the church, which parallels the author's own life. Metzger served as a pastor for a short period for two different southern churches before deciding the ministry was not a good fit for him.
I had some wonderful experiences in the parish, met some great people, but the pressures to sort of parrot back what the denomination stands for were too great. I was at the age where I was asking a lot of questions, and I wanted to explore more, and I felt like once you got into a parish, you had to sort of represent the denomination anywhere you went. You know, sort of, you had to be the company man, right? You're sort of the front man for this company, and I wasn't ready yet to play that role. And so that's true of the narrator, too. I don't think he's not even quite aware of that yet, and maybe is stumbling into that insight late in the novel. But he's struggling with that too.
Metzger describes Tom Maloney as someone who believes he has faith at the beginning of the book and at the end still feels he does, but maybe questioning it a bit, which in Metzger's view could be a good thing as he draws a parallel between his fictional character and some of the students he's taught over the years.
But at the same time, those who really do engage the questions thoughtfully and remain in conversation with their peers throughout the semester, they learn to own what they have. So they're not simply believing what their parents told them or what their pastor said, you know, for 10 years. They really begin to own it, and it's theirs, even if there's not that much there to believe anymore. What they do have is theirs, and I think they take pride in that.
Metzger says his favorite part of the book is a chapter devoted to a conference that Tom Maloney attends regarding the Methodist Church's view on homosexuality. A parade of people go to a microphone to address a panel and express diametrically opposite views on what the church's stance should be.
And I like that part of the book because you have both sides trying to state their case. And the narrator's just sort of recording all this stuff and observing it. but no firm conclusions are reached on the matter. At the end, I think, which allows a reader to sort of wrestle with this issue on their own, I think if an argument had been made, it would be less engaging. Essentially, you're just throwing a lot of voices out there, putting them into conversation, and you're asking the reader to just get mixed up in it and see where you come out.
Questions are raised, and at the end of the day, no answers are given, but the conversation is underway, a good start in the author's mind. Dim, by Greenville resident Jim Metzger, is published by Aberdeen Bay. I'm George Olson.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features you'd like to hear, drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org.